to order the meeting of the House Education Committee. The time is 8:05. And present, we have Representative Keller, Wilson, Edgman, Gardner, and Buick. And I'm Kathy Munoz, and I will be chairing the meeting today in Chair Seaton's absence. Representative Paul Seaton is attending his father's 100th celebration, birthday celebration, and we wish him well and his father well. And today we have the Department of Education Early Development Professional Teaching Practices Commission and the Post-Secondary Education Commission to provide overviews, department overviews, and program overviews. Telephonically, we have on the phone, rather, we have Patricia Truman. Ms. Truman, are you present?
Yes, I am.
Is she available?
I'm right here.
Okay, just as a reminder, we'd like to turn off all cell phones, please, and remind everybody to, of course, address questions through the chair. Again, we have the Director of Professional Teaching Practices, Ms. Truman.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me?
She's not available. Okay. Is Mark Lewis is here, Admin Services Director. Mark, would you like to come forward and answer questions or make a brief presentation while we wait for Ms. Truman?
Well, thank you. For the record, my name is Mark Lewis. I'm the Admin Services Director for the Department of Education. And actually, I could give you just a quick rundown on their budget, but I don't really have a lot of the details on the program itself. And so hopefully they can take care of the technical issues here in just a moment. if you wanted to turn to page 3 in the budget overview, if you still have it in front of you. If you don't, I can just speak to it anyway. It's really just it's a small change, but it's a big impact for the department and for this particular program. What we're asking to do here is do a fund source switch from receipt-supported services, which is the money that comes in through the teacher certification fees, and we're going to ask that it be funded with general fund. And the reason for that is in the teacher certification piece of our budget, they normally don't collect enough revenue to fully fund just the teacher certification section, and by splitting it up, it created a hardship for that particular program to operate. And so by doing that fund source switch, it allows the Professional Teaching Practices Commission to have a steady funding stream, and then it also gives the teacher certification section the opportunity to fully fund their section and complete their duties.
Okay, before we go on, are there questions on that?
What page of the budget?
If you look at page 3, you'll see on the Professional Teaching Practices Commission under Agency Operations, it's right about in the middle. And you'll see it under management plan.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is Patricia Truman. I called in to supposed to be giving an overview of the program of the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, and I can hear them, but they can't hear me. I'm on, but they're not hearing me.
If you'd like to continue, Mark, go ahead.
Well, actually, I don't have that much more on PTPC. It is a small unit.
Mm-hmm.
They only have two
people. Yeah, I can hear them, and they keep saying, are you on? I keep saying I am, but I'm not. So, I mean, I just don't want you to think I didn't call in.
So other than that, I really don't – I would really prefer that she speak to the program itself.
Okay.
Okay, well, I'll try to hang up and try again.
Sure. We'd like to take an at-ease while we get our telephone system up and running,
okay.
And appreciate you being here today, Mark. Thank you. Continue our presentation with the Executive Director of the Post-Secondary Education Commission, Ms. Diane Behrens, is here. And I think so that we can keep the meeting moving, we'll go ahead and move you up and then bring Patricia back on when we finally work it out.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you.
and I just click, is that right? Okay, thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education, and I appreciate this opportunity to brief the members on kind of the state of the commission and its programs today. I have prepared a PowerPoint, and for those of you who are intimately familiar with the history of the program, I'll apologize in advance. I thought it was important to understand where we are today within the context of the history of the organization, and so I've provided some background initially, and then we'll talk about the programs as they are today. So just briefly, and I'll try to move quickly through each of these segments to allow for questions from the members, but I'd like to cover our organizational history, the management, our objectives, the current environment, talk about the Alaska Advantage programs as they have been for the last several years, the financial context. I'll touch briefly on this, won't go into any real detail, as well as at the request of Chair Seaton, he asked that I talk about just some of the statewide non-loan financial aid programs that are available today so that you understand the context of what we offer today in light of the presentation by Mrs. Taylor last week. So the loan program was created in 1968 by the legislature. It was actually a program that predated the establishment of the Commission on Postsecondary Education. In 1974, through legislation, the commission was established as the state's coordinating, higher education coordinating, and financial aid agency. In those original statutes, there was some coordination authority for the commission that was later repealed. In 1981, the state of the loan program offered loans of up to $7,000 per year with 50% forgiveness. Of course, in those days, the program was fully general fund funded, and so those provisions were policy calls on the part of the legislature. In 1987, some of you may recall the effect on state government when oil dropped below $10 a barrel. The Alaska Student Loan Corporation was established at that time as an entity through which the loan programs would be financed going forward. In 1988, as a result of that, in recognition of that new financing source, the loan program, the terms of the loans had to change substantially. Loan forgiveness was removed. Trying to think of what else occurred in 88. That was the primary change in 88. There are subsequent changes over the years, but that was the most significant change at that time. So from 95 to 98, we continued to make significant changes to reverse financial losses that the corporation experienced. In 2001, And I'll get into those changes in a little bit more detail in subsequent slides. But in 2001, the positive effect of those changes, the cumulative effect of those changes, were such that the corporation was actually in a position to begin making annual returns to the state. In 2002, the legislature unanimously passed the legislation that essentially authorized us to enter a new phase in the corporation's history and the commission's history. In addition to adding federally guaranteed student loans to the loans that we offered, we also were charged with new duties to develop outreach and early awareness programs in Alaska. That was a clear void in services and programs that we had in the state. There was no statewide program to reach out to Alaskans and the families, the children, to encourage them to pursue post-secondary education as inherently important to their success further on. In 2003, we added an alternative consolidation loan program This allowed us to take the older, higher rate loans and offer consolidation to borrowers to help them reduce their costs on those higher rate loans. In 2004, our outreach area or unit added received a Lumina Foundation grant for College Goal Sunday in partnership with the financial aid officers in Alaska. We founded the Coalition of Alaskans Supporting Higher Education. And in 2005, the Alaska Legislature established the Alaska Advantage Education Grant Program. This is a grant program that allows us to leverage some student loan corporation receipts to capture federal matching funds. And in 2008, the governor designated us as Alaska's College Access Challenge Grant Program. The College Access Challenge Grant is a two-year federal grant that Congress authorized to every state, and the conditions being that they had to use that to promote college going and college access. So in 2009, using those College Access Challenge Grant funds, we're preparing to pilot a peer mentoring program. This will be an embedded program in the high school to target at-risk youth to help them overcome whatever administrative or financial burdens barriers may be in their way to going to college. The organizational structure of the commission, we actually are a partner entity. The Commission on Postsecondary Education develops and delivers higher education access and support services. The Student Loan Corporation underwrites the costs of these mission-related services. The commission is a 14-member board. I won't read the membership there, but you can see it's a rather diverse set of advisors on our commission. And the corporation is a 5-member board. Three seats are statutorily members of the governor's cabinet, the commissioners of administration, commerce, community, and economic development, and revenue. The governor also appoints 2 members from the commission to serve on the corporation board. This is just a summary of our staffing. You get an idea of the level of continuity we've had in senior leadership in the organization. We currently are authorized at 102 full-time employee positions. We have offices both in Juneau and Anchorage. Our large servicing operation is located here in Juneau, but our outreach and IT staff are based in our Anchorage office. I'm very pleased to report that we've recently relocated those offices to the Diamond Center. One of the objectives behind that relocation was to put our outreach staff and into a mall setting, essentially, where the students that we would most target would happen to be anyway. So we're real pleased with that, and we would invite any of you to stop by our Success Center. It's actually, if you're familiar with the Diamond Center, it's next door to the movie theaters, so a prime location for us there. Our organizational objectives are exactly as I've suggested: to promote, support, and provide access to post-secondary education in Alaska and for Alaskans. We do that by providing training access products and services. We promote post-secondary education participation in Alaska, and we do have a consumer protection role in that we authorize institutions to operate in Alaska. And I did leave with the committee staff some samples of the outreach documents that we produce on an annual basis, and I'll talk about our strategies for outreach later in the presentation. Our organizational objectives are to be sustainable, regardless of what is necessarily happening with the revenues of the state as they rise and fall. We want the corporation's programs to be structured in such a way that they are self-sustaining. We believe it is very important in Alaska to foster key institutional and organizational partnerships to improve the effectiveness of our outreach and early awareness and access programs. And internally, to have a suite of measures within the organization to be able to take our own temperature and assess our health operationally and from a management perspective. We have looked to continue to grow our loan portfolio while containing our administrative costs. I'm pleased to report to you that even though our loan volume has grown substantially in recent years, we have the same number of staff that we had in 1999, I believe.
Excuse me 1 minute. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Diane, how, you know, your portfolio now with this downturn in the stock market and everything, everybody seems to have been affected by it, and I'm sure your investments for this have also been affected?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, in fact, they have not.
Really?
And that is for good reason. Because of the nature of our business, we have very conservative investment policies, and so we are in sort of fixed rate investments that have specific terms. We don't have a great need of liquidity for our investments. We have to keep a certain amount of assets invested according to our policy and to provide a reserve for the corporation. So those rates were not impacted by the downturn in the capital markets.
Wonderful.
There were other impacts to us of the downturn in the capital markets, but not on the investment side.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Before we proceed, are there other questions? Representative Gardner.
Yes, actually, that was just too good a segue into the question that I have, because how is the interest rate that we charge to our student borrowers calculated, and can we reduce it now that the interest rate for other things is reduced?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, it is not tied to sort of the cost of overnight funds. Our interest rate is tied to the cost of administering the program plus the cost of the outstanding bonds. There is and here's where having my chief finance officer here would have been a good idea, but I wasn't sure how in detail we would go on the financial side. But they're tied to a money index that is not affected by these very, very low rates that you're seeing in government-supported coupons.
Okay, so if I were a student taking out a loan today, what would I expect that rate to be? Bearing in mind, too, that as a homeowner, I think I can get a 4% loan now under certain conditions.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Gardner, our highest rate that we're currently charging is 7.3%. The lowest rate we're charging, and on a later slide I kind of talk about the different types of programs, but if you borrow from our federal program, you may be charged below 5%. It just depends on whether or not you qualify for a government subsidized loan, whether or not you're using that loan in Alaska as opposed to elsewhere. We do try to incent and reward both repayment interest rates while the borrowers in the state, as well as attendance in the state.
Thank you.
So I wish there was a really simple answer, but there isn't. The good news is the highest rate is 7.3 right now.
And thank you, Madam Chair. How does that compare to other states?
It is the lowest alternative loan interest rate in the country.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Representative Wilson.
Sorry, that leads me to another question.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are the student loans then, are they fixed rate?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, they are fixed rate to the borrower.
Okay.
On the federal loan side, the rate that we as a federal lender receive is adjusted quarterly. But it is fixed to the borrower. Having said that, those are the loans we've made the last 2 years. From 2002 to 2006, they were variable rate in that they reset annually with a cap of 8.25%. So it was a different interest rate model that was in place. Congress changed the way in which the interest was set a couple of years ago, and so it moved from a variable rate to a fixed rate.
Thank you.
Our environment.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Representative Edgman has a question.
Thank you. And maybe you'll touch upon this later in your presentation, but I'm just trying to figure out how the loan program itself works. Is it similar to the concept of revolving loan where your portfolio makes money and you put the money back into the corpus of the fund?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, we're designed to be self-sustaining. When the corporation was created in 1988, the legislature transferred to it $306 million in loan assets. So those became the capital with which the corporation issued bonds. So we use the loans we make to secure the bonds we issue. The receipts on those loans are first pledged to repay the principal and interest on bonds, and then any remaining above that goes back into the fund. We originate more loans with it. And as I mentioned, since 2001, we've annually calculated a return or a dividend to the state as well.
And the fund is managed by the Department of Revenue?
The corporation manages its own investments. And with the construct of the corporation board, clearly there's a nexus between revenue and the Student Loan Corporation. So the board sets the policy for investments. We do have some of our funds that we have asked the Department of Revenue to invest, the ones that we need to keep fairly liquid. And so they do essentially do that as a fee for service.
Okay. I just have one question before you go on. Because the proceeds of the loans pay off the bonds, then it's assumable then that you cannot, that forgiveness loan programs then cannot be paid with through the traditional means of financing that you're now using, that it would require a general fund subsidy. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. In order for if the state were to, again, have a program that would entitle a borrower to a discharge of their debt automatically for whatever reasons, service, residents in the state, they would need to forward fund the cost of that with general funds. You could not use an asset that you could not fully collect on to collateralize a bond. There would be no investors for that bond.
Okay. Representative Buick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you explain how it was done in the past? Up until 88?
Yes.
That program was in place, and it was, I think, fairly effective, except for the problem of recovering some of those monies was the problem. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative, is it Book?
Book. Yes. Book. Thank you.
It was fully funded by the state general fund, and so the decision at that time was that for public policy reasons, the expectation was that only half of those loans would be repaid because, in theory, everyone would return to the state and remain in the state and qualify for forgiveness of half of their principal and interest. So that's how it functioned. In terms of its efficacy, I believe about 20% of those that were eligible for it were actually able to receive the benefit due to a combination of factors. One is you had to complete the degree or certificate for which the loan was offered, and then you had to return to the state within a year and remain for up to 5 years for the full benefit. From a managerial standpoint, the concern was that you had students, and this is my theory, I don't know that I would have be able to really factually bear this out, but just looking at our default rate, it appeared that students were not understanding that it was a real debt, the entire amount of the debt. They may have borrowed more than they actually needed because in their mind they were cutting the numbers in half. But we had default rates on those loans that approached 28% over time. So the loss to the corporation, because these became the assets that were transferred to us, was quite substantial. As I mentioned in one slide, at the worst, the corporation had a $50 million equity deficit because of losses on these loans.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
So in terms of our environment, we do have a record of positive performance. As a public enterprise agency, we see ourselves as an enterprise agency and try to operate accordingly with the corporation and commission. In my role as the executive director of the commission, I'm also the executive officer of the Student Loan Corporation. I'm the corporation's only employee, but the employees of the commission service the programs of the corporation, and they do so under an agreement between the corporation and the commission. We have enjoyed long-standing bipartisan support, I think, for each of the pieces of legislation that we have asked for since as long ago as 1995. They passed unanimously with unanimous support, and I think I can say that the corporation and commission are viewed as a successful model of a government enterprise organization. In terms of the programs themselves, and this gets, I think, a little to your question, Representative Book, the programs from 68 to 87 was really seen as a state entitlement program. It was fully financed by the state general fund. If you were 16 years or older and were attending an institution that was approved in Alaska or accredited elsewhere, you could receive these loans. We had no other requirement. No cosigner was required. No collateral was required. Everybody knew that if you got your certificate or degree and remained in the state or returned to the state, up to half of your loan would be forgiven. So it was a different loan. There was no interest charge during the in-school period. There was a 12-month grace period at the end of your in-school period. And so I think the combination of these factors did lead to a sense that it wasn't a debt like your other debt. And it wasn't a debt like your other debt. And at that time, the real focus was getting the money to the students to get into school, not on collecting loans for the state. I would also mention that around the loan program, at the height, I believe there were 144 authorized institutions in the state. So the ready availability of student loans in Alaska led to perhaps a development of institutions that literally there was not a market demand for. I believe today in the state there are fewer than 45 approved schools. So from 88 to 93, after the corporation was created, there was a series of changes. I think there was concern about a sudden drastic change to the program, but gradually the terms and conditions under which the loans were offered became more business-oriented in terms of making sure the program could sustain itself going forward. So we had a 1% loan origination fee. The interest rate was raised to 8% during repayment. The grace period was shortened. We actually, prior to the early 1990s, when a student entered repayment, we would literally send them a coupon book for their 120 payments and expect them to just make their payments when due. And that was great for the students who had completed their accounting degree, but I think it was a bit more of a struggle for the rest of us. So internally, we started to make some changes. In 92, we did have a servicing system conversion that failed catastrophically. I think there may be some members here who might still remember that. We literally had to shut down the phones for 6 weeks while people worked on trying to fix the conversion. It was not a happy time. And then we had an external servicing audit by Deloitte and Touche in 1993 that, as a result of which, the insurer on our bonds refused insurance. So things were in a pretty serious state at that point. And as I mentioned, with annual losses for each of the first 10 years of the corporation's operation, we were then at an equity deficit of about $50 million. In 1993, for the first time, the commission hired an executive director who actually had a student loan background. That was my predecessor, Dr. Joe McCormick, who, although he was here for only a short period of time, less than 2 years, I think, he set in motion a series of changes. He was able to come to the legislature with his professional background and say, these are the things that if you do, we can turn this around. So we began another series of legislative changes. We tied loan rates to the cost of the program. Our collection methods were expanded. We had already had the ability to garnish permanent fund dividends, but in addition to that, we were authorized to administratively issue liens, to garnish wages, to leverage occupation professional licenses. And some modest credit standards were added to the eligibility criteria. That occurred in 1998, and that standard, as it is today, is that no credit is good credit, but if you do have, by a show of your credit history, that you perform poorly on your credit obligations, you're required to apply with a creditworthy cosigner. So we did a variety of things. I think you may have a copy of this, so I won't go into every detail, but you get a sense of the shift in the organization.
Excuse me, we have a question from Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I just want to make sure I understand you're saying if an applicant has no credit history whatsoever, that's treated as good credit. If they have bad credit, they need a cosigner?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's correct.
Thank you.
So from 2002 to the present, you can see the kind of the statistics. The number of authorized institutions participating in the program dropped from 140 to fewer than 40. We did set in place stricter standards for the institutions that participated in our programs, and they did have to enter into a program participation agreement as to their responsibilities in administering the loans. One key element there is we calculate loan default rates annually. We also calculate them for each institution that participates in the program. If an institution should see that its default rate is above a certain level, then there are actions that they have to take to try to do debt counseling, default aversion, and if they're unable to bring the default rate at that institution below a certain level, then they may no longer participate in the state loan program. In order to participate in the federal loan program, they have to be an accredited institution, either regionally or nationally. So by 2000, we had erased the corporation's equity deficit. We were once again on solid financial administrative platform, and we were about to begin paying dividends to the state. These annual dividends have ranged from less than $1 million to, I think, the highest was maybe $5 million 1 year. We added the Federal Family Education Loan Program to the programs we offered so that Alaskans could have a one-stop for their aid. That new program was authorized in 2001. We now operate as a one-stop for those residents who choose to utilize the full array of our programs. So the Federal Family Education Loan Program, which we started in 2002, we qualify as a state agency nonprofit lender. We have been the number one lender in this program since we began offering those loans. And in our current in the last fiscal year that ended, we had $34 million in federal loans awarded. You can see that there has been a jump. The $40.6 million awarded through December of last year, we do expect a 51% growth in that program over the prior year. The Supplemental Education Loan Program is a successor program to the old Alaska Student Loan Program. We do promote it as supplemental to the federal loan. The federal loan has terms and conditions that are much more beneficial to students, so we encourage them to take that loan first. Currently, we do not require them to, but institutions may require that the students complete the free application for federal student aid, which would automatically put a student into the pool for the federal loans. The loans in the Supplemental Education Loan Program, we actually use a municipal market data insured AMT revenue bond yield curve, which if you have questions about that, I'll have to have our finance officer get back to you, plus 30 basis points and administrative costs. The minimum rate for the alternative loans is a half a percent above the federal loan rate, and that's to encourage students to use the federal loan rate, the federal loan, if they qualify. The interest rate reset on the old alternative loans is reset each July, and the corporation announces the interest rates for these before the start of each year. For the last 2 years, the rate has been set at the minimum of 7.3%. In this program for fiscal year 08, we loaned just under $44 million. And year to date in this program is $34.9 million. Consistent with the trend we've seen in recent years, the borrowing through this program is declining. And that is because the federal loan is being increasingly used by Alaskans.
Ask a question.
Sure. Representative Edgman.
You have a minimum rate. And you probably have a maximum rate as well, but I'm thinking of the Division of Investments, and Greg Winninger's on your board, your five-member board, but they have a maximum rate of 10.5%, and we're probably talking apples and oranges here, but their rate can also go down considerably. In fact, we have a bill in the Fisheries Committee tomorrow that may allow for energy efficiency loans as low as 2%, and I guess I'm sitting here thinking that your program had some pretty tough times up until the late 80s. You've recovered now, but you're in some ways sort of a different animal than the Division of Investments loan program, so I'm going to surmise.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I'm not familiar with the programs that are run out of Mr. Winninger's shop. I do know that one of the things the corporation has done, rather than set a fixed rate that is very low based on the current conditions for a particular year, what the corporation has done is assessed its financial capacity to reduce costs year to year, and so they approve a set of borrower benefits that we apply as credits and reductions for a one-year-at-a-time period. They're reset every year. For instance, we have, if you're repaying your loan and you use our recurring WebPay methodology for an automatic deduction, we reduce your rate 0.25%. If you make 48 on-time payments once you've begun your repayment period, we'll reduce your loan 2%. We have a program. For the period of time leading up to 2002, we actually had our interest rates on some of our loans that were as high as 9%. We've had what we call a borrower cost reduction program, where we annually go in and apply a credit to those higher rate loans to reduce their equivalent interest cost to about 8. Well, we cap it at 8.3, so anything above 8.3 is credited back. So the theory being that we know from year to year what we have the capacity to do. We can't necessarily project based on all the various factors that would impact income to the corporation, what we'll have for a 10 to 15 year period of time over repayment, that's the best method to ensure sustainability for the program, but still give money back to the borrowers when we have the capacity to do so.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm very glad to hear that, because I was struck by learning that the corporation actually makes dividend payments back to the state under some conditions, and it seems to me that if we really want, if the whole idea of the program is to help Alaskan students continue their education, that somehow for the state to get dividends on that opportunity means we're not maximizing the benefit to students. Mm-hmm. So if the loan terms and conditions support the effort to process them and whatever your overhead costs are, it seems to me that everything else ought to be to the student benefit and not a state dividend, but it sounds like you're kind of doing that.
To the chair, Representative Gardner, we are. I would tell you that the view of the legislature in looking at its public corporations has been that they are corporations that were, at least in our case, originally capitalized by the state, and that it's not unreasonable to expect some return after the mission's been met. So to the extent that we have net income after all of our other costs have been paid, of course, up to one-third of that can be paid back to the state according to the statute that governs our dividends. So that is a policy call. It's permissive. It's not mandatory. And I would advise you that this year the corporation acted took the action that there will not be a dividend paid to the state for FY10. So that we communicated that to OMB. They understood the circumstances in which that occurred. And you would see that the dividends have actually dropped in recent years as we've had very robust borrower benefits. So I think it's a balancing.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Diane, I have one question. Just explain to me, if we didn't have a drop, what precipitated the not giving the dividend this year? If we didn't have a drop in the investment part, you know, the return, what is the reason, I guess?
Okay. Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, even though the corporation continues to operate in a very healthy mode, the environment within which we now live has changed radically. The capital markets that we issued bonds in has literally gone away. Since 2002, the corporation had issued auction rate securities. That market collapsed in February of 2008. We have not been able to issue bonds in the market. There is another variable rate mode that we could issue in, except that there is such, on the issuer side, there's such demand for the financial partners in those issuances that the costs have raised to a point where they're not economical for us. So as a result, our 2008, 2009 loans have all been funded with cash. Assets, receipts that we had coming in were used to fund those loans. We expect that annual volume to top out at $95 million. We will have exhausted our capacity to internally originate loans. So it seemed contrary to be sending cash back to the state when, in fact, we were cash strapped ourselves.
Okay, thank you.
And this shows some of the borrower benefits that we have in place this year. I will not kid you, when the corporation resets borrower benefits for this year, it will not be this robust. But these are the benefits that we offer. And it is rather complicated, but what we're trying to do with the benefits is not only to reduce borrower costs, but to incent and reward certain behaviors. We want to incent students to borrow from our federal Alaska Advantage loan. That is the lowest cost loan to them currently. And through the benefits, we reduce the cost still further. If they attend school in Alaska or return to Alaska after they've entered repayment, we have an additional reduction of their costs associated with that. We call that the Alaska Presence benefit, which is about the third benefit from the bottom. That's a 1% credit, annual credit on the federal loan, and a 0.5% credit on the ASEL. So you can see that the benefits vary, but a significant portion of the loans are eligible. The two far right columns indicate the percentage of eligible borrowers who actually received the benefit. As you can see, the highest utilization benefit is the, or eligibility is the Alaska Presence. The highest utilization is the general benefit because almost everybody gets that. Any?
Yes.
Go ahead. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Is your definition of residency, does that parallel the permanent fund division's definition?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, they need to be residing in Alaska. And if they are, if their loan is being serviced either because they're attending a school in Alaska or they're the location we have for them is in Alaska, we give them the benefit. We don't have a application process. We don't go through a complicated validation process. If they're attending a school in Alaska or their servicing address is in Alaska, they receive the benefit.
And just as a quick general comment, I remember a couple years ago when I was working outside the legislature, we struggled mildly with defining residency, and we went to this. I had my staff go to the state website, and we came up with like three or four different definitions of residency in the various state programs. So I just bring that up as a question, I guess, an observation.
This shows you what our loan volume has been in recent years. 2003, we were just under $60 million. With the addition of the federal programs, you can see that we really advanced in our federal loan volume kind of in leaps and bounds. We expect that to continue going forward. One of the key positive things with the federal program in recent years is the Congress actually increased the loan limit, the annual loan limit under the federal program. And so now if you're a freshman and an independent student, which the majority of our students are independent, you can borrow $9,500 a year through the federal program. Congress is currently considering in the fiscal stimulus proposal an additional $2,000 a year. The concern here is that because the cost of education has continued to rise, that students are looking more to private loans, alternative loans, and there are only a few states that have a program like ours. All the others, the students would be looking to banks, which have very high credit standards and typically have interest rates that are substantially higher than what you would see through a state-supported program such as ours.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Diane, do you ever counsel students? I talked with one the other day, and she was really having a hard time making her payments, but they were $1,200 a month. And do you counsel them when they get up to a certain amount to see if what they're going to school for is going to give them a good enough income that they're going to be able to make the payments? Is there any kind of counseling that's done or on that? Because for what she was doing, I thought, oh my goodness, you know.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, what we do is provide tools where they can sort of counsel themselves. I don't know that it would be appropriate for us to question their choice of a career and their decision to incur debt directly with them. However, for instance, on our we have a software that we support statewide. It's called AKCIS. It's the Alaska Career Information System. It's a partnership with Labor and Education. And it has a program in it, and I would encourage you to check it out. It's akcis.org. That's called Reality Check. And it literally walks a person, maybe a young person, maybe an older person, through a decision process about what lifestyle they would like to have. And as they pick the different elements of the lifestyle, including what their career choices are, it will show them the cost of that lifestyle. It will show them the income associated with the career. and so that they can, for themselves, ask themselves those questions, and what amount of education debt can I afford to incur and still be within the realm of reality. So we have those types of tools that we make available online. I do know that our customer service agents do counsel strongly that the federal education loan program is the best loan program for you. On the repayment side, there are income-sensitive repayment schedules. You can extend the term over the life of the loan, and there's even discharge available to borrowers after they have repaid for a number of years. So that is the program of choice, and we do try to encourage students to use that.
Please continue. Thank you.
So this next slide, we've just projected loan demand through 2012. We do expect to see our loan demand jump over $100 million next year, and then probably have the growth slow thereafter. Our loan servicings, as I mentioned, the commission does originate and internally service all the loans. We do contract with a collection agency for those loans that are very distressed. Typically, they are over a year in arrears, and the borrower is non-responsive to internal collection efforts. Rather than continue to use internal resources to try to collect those loans, we do transfer them for collection. So all the standard lending activities, and we do have an internal business process analysis, which is ongoing, analyzes how we do what we do, and makes both qualitative and efficiency recommendations. I just think this is interesting. We are actually very fortunate in that a huge percentage of our borrowers in repayment use the automated WebPay. We're about to deploy enhancements to our online payment options because we've increasingly had family members call, employers call and say, you know, here's a situation, we'd like to make payments on this individual's account for whatever reason. And so we're setting up an option for a third party payer to make payment without getting access to the private information of the borrower. We do have enhanced collection levers, as I mentioned. We have some modest credit review currently, cosigner requirements. I mentioned the institutional default rate management requirements for high default institutions. And we do have an origination fee, which we collect. Those are put into a fund, and when we have to write off loans due to death, disability, or uncollectability, we're able to recoup some of our costs against that fund. Our collection tools are fairly robust, and we also have skip tracing tools that are quite robust as well. The access to state databases for the purposes of locating borrowers and getting updated addresses has been very, very helpful. Under our institution, I'll sort of leave loans for a while because we do other things. It's just that the loans fundamentally are the engine that keeps the organization running, and so I tend to focus on those quite a bit. Institutional authorization, we do approve post-secondary education institutions in Alaska. We also approve a number of them for exemptions. There are a number of training organizations that simply don't fall into the true category of post-secondary education institutions, and they are deemed as exempt from authorization. Examples would be cooking schools. If you buy software from somebody and they offer training on that software, that's the type of study that would be excluded from authorization. We do investigate student complaints related to institutions, and we enforce institutional closure rules. We are the repository for student records in the event of a school closure. Our other mission-related agency activities.
Diane, oh. Representative Wilson has a question.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Diane, do you work, for instance, when Sheldon Jackson closed in and that was a private entity and not a state entity, but there were student records there that had to be transferred on over to our university, and were you involved in that at all?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, we were. We are the repository for all Sheldon Jackson's academic records. So our newest unit, and this is actually the one that's fun to talk about, is our outreach and early awareness programs. We do feel that it's very important in Alaska because of our poor performance as a state in terms of the number of students going on to college and completing some sort of certificate or degree, that this is where we really have to put our energy going forward. We are focused on developing a college-going culture. We use the term college to be PAN, post-secondary education. It's everything from job training to vocational programs to full-blown graduate programs. We believe that Alaska needs skilled workers in every category. So we do provide technical advice and assistance to the legislature when they're working on program development. We've also increasingly worked with departments of labor and education to make sure that there's connectedness between organizations with overlapping missions. In our outreach programs, we have what we call age-based sequence outreach. It actually starts as early as the second grade and continues through the level of adult. Our outreach staff, which are based in South Central, do community visits and presentations. College Goal Sunday, I mentioned, is an annual event, which is incidentally next Sunday, and you can check our website for a location near you. We hope to have a good turnout this year, and that is a statewide event that we do through partnerships with a variety of partners in the state. AKCIS, which I mentioned, and career planning awareness. AKCIS actually has an AKCIS Junior, which starts with the junior high level and then also has applications that are appropriate for high school and beyond. The AKCIS is a new service that we provide. We began doing this in 2008. Previously, it was run through the Department of Labor and was available to schools in Alaska on a fee basis. We have picked up the cost of that, and so now every school in Alaska has that on a no-cost basis to them. Additionally, we've added a feature on AKCIS. Previously, you had to be affiliated with a site, a job center or a school. You can now, as an Alaskan, go in and using your area code, you can log in, create your own profile, store information, do searches for programs of study, and I think the functionality with just that one change was improved immensely. The community mentors, which is new, that is something that we're piloting in Service High this year. And we hope that if we're able to have this peer mentor program going forward, that we'll be able to develop interest in funding it and deploying it statewide.
Excuse me, Representative Book.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you mentioned peer mentors, and here you're talking about community mentors. Who does this include?
Through the chair, Representative Book, this is a typo on my part. I should have had peer mentors here. Okay. This is the same. This is exactly the same thing.
In that vein, mm-hmm. Have you considered other components of the community as well to bring them in as volunteers? An example, the seniors that may have retired as educators and are still in the community. Has that been a consideration?
Through the chair, Representative Book, we have not gotten there yet. It's something that we have discussed. Our focus has been with the resources that we have available, has been on getting these programs out the door, ready, sustainable, and effective. But it is very clear one of the areas that we have not, besides sort of the senior or elder method, is adult outreach. That is something that we have not substantially gotten into yet, but it is something that we're aware is an area of growth for us.
Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Gardner?
He asked actually the question that I was just formulating in my mind, too. But if we limit ourselves to talking just about peer mentors, are these students who have graduated, gone off, and done other things coming back to their school, or are they all students within the building working together?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the mentors we're recruiting are within a year of graduating from college. We want them to be able to speak in a very current way with students. We want them to be close to the student's age as we can, but we want them to have to also be able to model the behavior. So these are the two folks that we have graduated from college within the last year, and they'll be working in the high school, embedded there, working with the counselors that are there as well.
So they're actually employed?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Book.
Thank you. So you've mentioned that you're looking in different avenues for utilization of some of your directions. Have you utilized other than people that are in colleges for some of these directions and some of these pathways, or whatever you want to call them, for some of these students? Or is this basically for college-oriented curricula?
Through the chair, Representative Book, the idea will be to encourage a student to have a plan of action that will provide them a skilled trade.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Diane, you have two students now that do this?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, as of tomorrow, I think we will. This is brand new. This is a pilot phase. The recruitment completed 2 weeks ago. We made a hire. The students will start. They're actually, we've modeled this on a program out of North Carolina, and we're sending them off for training. And so we will have them in a minute.
Follow-up?
Sure.
So it's a pilot program, so what high school are they going to go
Service.
To?
Service.
Is that the name of our high school?
Okay. Yeah, that's a Bush high
school. And through the chair, Representative Wilson, what we looked for was a high school with a very diverse population. Service is quite a diverse high school, and it has a large portion of our at-risk population, lower-income students.
Follow-up. Are they both going to be at the same school then?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we thought it was important in deploying the program to have a structure where there could be collegial support, mm-hmm. rather than just because they're kind of writing their own process. And the idea is after this spring term to really analyze what worked, what didn't work, and make any needed modifications to the structure of the program, allow that to inform the second year of the program. One of the things we're aware of is that that what works as an urban model may not work for a rural model, so we're very mindful of that fact, and the plan in year two is to try to figure out, so if we are going to deploy this beyond the urban setting in Alaska, what will that look like?
And one more question. What's the ADM at that high school of the number of students?
I'll have to get back with you on that. I don't know the number of students that they have.
Is it a big school?
It's a big school, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And then the last thing. Some of you may have seen the white paper that the commission produced last year, making Alaska more competitive by preparing Alaskans for college and career. It was a study of the current situation in Alaska, and it made it very clear that we have no place to go but up in terms of having students prepared and understanding how important post-secondary education is to them.
Sure. Representative Edgman.
Well, if I have a quizzical look on my face, it's because, you know, making people in Alaska more prepared, but the emphasis, as best I can gather, and this is by no means a criticism, I think it's more a comment on how successful your program has been, but it seems that the emphasis is on college, whereas, you know, back to some speech of a few days ago, we're a resource development state, got these big projects coming online, hopefully can have a lot of jobs available for both that are people who are got engineering degrees and degrees in management and so forth, but also for people who have gone through vocational education programs. So a little bit of a disconnect in my mind in terms of making Alaska more competitive, but also with the sort of almost, you know, the predominant message just being post-secondary college and so forth. But the question to you is that the mission of your program, is to sort of focus on all of the above, but with the promoting more of college education emphasis?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, again, I think our mission is to prepare, to encourage Alaskans to prepare themselves for a college, for career or college. And for some, that will mean college. For others, it will mean a career training program of some kind. And again, I use the word college to mean all of the above. And if you look at recent reports from testing organizations, they make it very clear that the differences in being prepared for technical and trade school and college in terms of your preparatory program in high school, it's only an application of what you've learned that is different, that the essence of the curricula and what you should be prepared to be able to do to be successful in either a technical-oriented training program or a standard sort of general education program are really the same in terms of math skills, in terms of critical thinking. And so we believe that if you train your students in high school to be focused on post-secondary education, they're going to be ready to make any choice they want to make once that decision threshold appears.
So just a quick
Thank
follow-up.
You, sir.
What percentage of your programs, your loans, actually reside in the Voc-Tech area?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, that's actually difficult to say because substantially most of the vocational training is occurring at the University of Alaska. So we would literally have to run reports to see who's in a we do have categories of programs and we can look at that. But I would estimate that maybe as high as 20% are actually in a sub-BA level program. So an associate degree or shorter.
Okay, Representative Book.
Thank you. Could you repeat that data again? You said how much was currently at a university level, vocational education?
Through the chair, Representative Book, I said the majority of vocational education training in the state is being delivered by the University of Alaska. I don't have a percentage, but that's my understanding that of the programs, referencing President Hamilton's statements that he's made publicly, they have added, I think it's over 60 programs, all of which are at the associate or below level, all of which I think you would consider vocational or technical training.
Okay.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Diane. Before we go on, is Patricia Truman still on? Is she online? Okay, let's go ahead and allow about 15 more minutes for this part of the presentation, and then we can move into the presentation on the Professional Teaching Commission. Oh, wait, is she not coming through? Okay, well, we'll go until 9:30. And at that point, if Patricia's online, then we'll move into that presentation.
I think
go ahead. Go ahead and continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So our age-appropriate sequenced activities, I mentioned we have a second grade classroom reading program. We partnered with University of Alaska. In the fifth grade, we've got I'm Going to College. It's an orientation where we take the kids onto campuses in their neighborhoods. We just promote the idea of college going through materials that are provided from the fifth to eighth grade, posters, the newspaper that hopefully you have a copy of. Going to College in Alaska is a publication that we make to promote Alaska institutions. I think all of the accredited institutions are included, including Avtec and a couple of the private institutions in the state. And then just a planning calendar for high school seniors that reminds them when there's testing dates, admission dates, et cetera. Our College Goal Sunday, it's free help filling out the FAFSA. This year we'll have 30 locations statewide, and it is in partnership. AKCIS, which I've talked about at length, I'm Going to College. We currently have this program up and operating for 2009 in the communities listed. And then I Know I Can, and I know this is kind of out of order. I Know I Can is a second grade program where we introduce the concept of college and career to second graders.
Excuse me, Representative Wilson had a question. Representative Wilson, could we hold our questions until the end of this part of the presentation, and then if we have time, we'll go ahead and allow additional questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is just a map of communities in Alaska that our outreach staff have been involved in. And what we try to do is certainly the ones that are highly populated, we have staff there for presentations and outreach activities on an annual basis. But every other community, we would try to get to at least once every 2 years, maintaining communication with them in the interim on programs and services. We do try to do web delivery when possible of our outreach presentations. And outreach presentations can be financial literacy presentations. They can be college and career planning presentations. We involve faith-based organizations in those, community organizations. I know that when our outreach folks are in some of these communities, it's a village event. Everybody shows up, and so it really optimizes the time that our folks have on the ground there. So in the 21st century, these are some of the things that we point to as signs of positive, at least internal change. We're very candid that we're not moving the bar the way we'd like to in terms of actual performance in our key indicator, which is Alaskans going on to post-secondary education and succeeding. We have seen a slight increase in the number of low-income Alaskans who are going, but overall our number has not increased. So we do offer Alaskans the lowest cost financial aid package in the nation, which I mentioned. New Jersey claims that they do. They're wrong. We, at a small scale, we offer grants for needy students. In the current year, we expect to make approximately $1.3 million in grants to about 1,600 students attending in Alaska. We had returned in the capital projects area, we had returned $160 million to the state for capital projects. That happened in 2004 and 2005, and in order to do that, the Student Loan Corporation actually issued bonds backed by student loan assets to fund those projects. In terms of 2008 accomplishments, you have this listed, but we have returned $24 million in cumulative borrower benefits to Alaskans through December of last year. On average, we provided $500,000 in grants. That was for fiscal year 2008. It's the amount was increased in the current year. We expanded the grant program to add priority for students pursuing careers in process industries, natural resource extractions, Our interest rates for FY 2008 range from a low of 2.25% to 7.3%. Outreach to almost 40,000 Alaskans at almost 500 events statewide. And through the undergraduate exchange, which we facilitate the WICHE programs at the Commission, over 1,600 Alaska students attended outside of Alaska without foregoing their residency and saving them just under $12 million in tuition discounts. The cumulative dividend to the Alaska General Fund is $32 million since 2001, and we've attracted $6 million dollars in to Alaska's higher education system by offering financial aid to non-residents. The goals and challenges, we continuing to offer Alaskans low-cost financial aid. The federal Congress did reduce the subsidy that we receive on the federal loans. We've had upheavals in the financial markets, which I referenced earlier. So we're looking at strategies to avoid a disruption in our lending activities. We're currently talking with folks at Revenue about how we might be able to offset some of the current market conditions that exist, and supporting program expansion without jeopardizing our ability to be self-sustaining. Another thing that we've become more active in recent years is trying to get recognition of state financial aid programs and services. I've found in dealing with the folks at the U.S. Department of Education that they kind of think the world begins and ends within the Beltway, and don't always understand the need for their programs to complement the programs that states are independently offered. Senator Murkowski has proven to be a strong advocate for us there, and my hope is that Senator Begich will as well. But Senator Murkowski's position on the Senate Help Committee is certainly places her in a good position to raise these issues. And this is just the last couple of slides. Representative Seaton had asked me to talk about what is currently available, just so you are aware of what is currently available to Alaskans in terms of non-loan aid. So I just briefly summarize the UA Scholars Award, which you're probably all aware of. It's an $11,000 scholarship for use over a four-year period of time. They are the top 10%. This may have been expanded to 15% in the current year, the top 15%. I know there was interest in doing that. I'm not sure what the outcome was. The award is paid out incrementally, $1,375 for each semester. There is a GPA requirement for them. Besides being in the top 10% of their class, they have to maintain a GPA of 2.5 or better. On the Alaska Advantage Grant, our grant is a last dollar needs-based grant. That means the student must have applied for and exhausted other grant aid, and that's to make sure we're stretching the dollars as far as we possibly can across the eligible population, and it's for up to $2,000 a year. The standard grant is $1,000 a year, but if they're in one of the priority fields, or if they are a high-achieving high school student in terms of having a high ACT or SAT score, they qualify for the second $1,000. So through 2008, our grants were funded with a mix of federal LEAP dollars and student loan corporation funds. That was changed in FY09. We did receive a capital appropriation. We spent about half of that in the current year, and we'll have half of that to spend next year. The objectives between these two programs, and they are really the only statewide non-loan programs available currently, is that they are statewide, they're Alaska-centered, you have to be attending in Alaska to benefit from them, and they do incent certain behaviors in terms of academic achievement. But both are tenuously funded. I think the university folks would tell you that their ability to keep the money flowing into Alaska scholars is a challenge for them. With the Student Loan Corporation, we have used earnings from our origination fee. Most of our receipts are pledged in some way. but the earnings from the origination fee account have been used to fund this grant program. But that too, if we were to see a jump in the number of loans we were writing off, that fund would shrink, and therefore its earnings would shrink. So there's lots of variables. Neither of the programs require a college prep curriculum, and neither program ensures broad-based access to non-loan aid for Alaska students. So there is no, when you're talking to students and tell them what is out there for them if they achieve, it's tentative. You cannot make any assurance to them that if they do this, that, and the other than being the top 10% of their class, that the aid will be there for them. So it lacks certainty. That's what the program's really absent. And that's the end of my
presentation. Thank you, Diane, very much. Excellent presentation. Really appreciate all the good work that you're doing at the commission, and appreciate you coming today. Before we go on, I wanted to ask, is Patricia Truman online? Patricia, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm online. Can you hear me?
I barely
hear you. Okay.
Patricia, I'm going to ask that we reschedule your presentation on the Professional Teaching Practices Commission for either Wednesday or Friday. And Louis Flora, the committee aide for this committee, will get in contact with you to set that up. We also have Eddie Jeans here with the commission, and I'll invite you up, Eddie, to answer questions that may come up of committee members. But before we go on, I know committee members have additional questions for Diane, so we'll go ahead and open that the floor up for questions now. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I have two different questions, and I can hold off on one if the chair likes, but there's been discussion of additional scholarship programs. We had a presentation from the Taylor Foundation, if the name's correct, about merit-based scholarships. And there are also people lobbying for doing more in terms of need-based scholarships, particularly given the rate of students who start on a higher education path and don't complete it. Do you believe that we need either or both of those kinds of programs?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, my advice has always been that I think you can structure a single program to combine those elements rather than choose one or the other. In terms of the success of the program, I think you're well served to combine both elements. And I would say without a doubt, Alaska would reap benefits from a program that has certainty, that does incent students to be fully prepared to enter a post-secondary training without remediation, or to be successful in even being considered for an apprenticeship program. In my conversations with folks who run apprenticeship programs, they're often hard put to find a student or an applicant with the skills they need to be successful in a technical training program. So I think you can do all of that in a single program.
Thank you. And one more question. As the FAFSA application, and I understand that to apply really for any kind of loan or grant program, a FAFSA application is also required. At what point is the parent's income no longer a factor? I mean, we have students who may have paid their own way up in, you know, the first 2 years of school, and they're looking for grants the third year, and they've been independent of their parents. Mm-hmm. But still the parents' income is required, even if the parents aren't able or willing to participate in the educational costs.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the federal rules around that are very specific in terms of the length of time a person of a certain age, under a certain age, has to be living independently from their parents. It's 3 years. If you're married, you're automatically independent. If you have a child, you're automatically independent. But beyond that, financial aid professionals can exercise judgment, I believe, but they're required to do so very carefully in terms of deeming someone to be independent.
Thank you.
Representative Keller had a question.
I believe the your program has a mission for access to post-secondary, and as I understand the Taylor program, I don't know if it's equally obviously theirs is about access also, but they also really include the aspect of maintaining post-secondary standards, or at least the student's bar that the student has to get over. And I was wondering, would we need to adjust the mission statement of your program in order to incorporate that aspect of it? I want to say equally, but to me they're very hard to separate access and the challenge and the incent that is there.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Keller, I think it's well within our mission to promote programs of that kind that have meritorious elements to them. Access doesn't do it. I mean, people have to be prepared to be successful. The worst situation is to have a student go into a post-secondary program, particularly if they're funding it with debt, and not be successful. If you spend 2 years doing remedial courses in college, under some circumstances, you can actually be incurring debt for that. You are worse off at the end of the day if you're not able to advance beyond that level because of the debt you've incurred. So I think it's key.
And a follow-up, please.
Thank you. That encouraged me. Thank you. I just wanted to point out that, I think it was 2000, the first time I sat in this room and listened to Diane's report. And it's always a sterling performance, and I know of no skeletons in this organization's closet. It's all on the table. I've always been stunned by the integrity and the openness, and I just wanted to say a sincere thank you. You also demonstrate a respect for the legislators' responsibility to make the policy decisions, and sincere thank you.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Representative Book.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things that come to mind immediately. There's a vast amount of availability out there other than what you have talked about today. People in outlying areas because of race, whatever, they have availability of some education for free. And being access to the bush and being involved with advocating for skill level training at all levels in elementary schools, grade schools, high schools, it became apparent to me that there's a vast availability out there of things that are free that people aren't taking advantage of. And I was wondering if you do some coordinating with those agencies as well in your education. I don't even need an answer to that. These are all rhetorical questions. And whether or not you focus on other things than debt or indebtedness, such as scholarships or grant writing, to promote, a result that doesn't incur debt as an education in what you're doing. And lastly, I want to dovetail with my colleague in saying that I'm firsthand experienced in the successes that you have had because of what you're doing, and I want to congratulate you. One of my wife's nieces just came through the system. She was a four-point student. She utilized all of the kinds of advantages at UAA, came out with an excellent education, and she in fact has money in the bank at the end of the day because she also worked. So in acknowledging the opportunities that are presented, I think that we're doing far better than some places. We're all here because we're really not satisfied and want to do better, but in some ways we are excelling, and we need to acknowledge that as well. So I do appreciate where you've come from. Thank you for that.
Were there additional questions? have one question on the Western undergraduate exchange program. What are the career categories that that program targets?
The undergraduate exchange program is an interesting one. The institutions in the West that participate set their own criteria. So it really depends on what their institutional objective is in participating in the undergraduate exchange. Some simply want to increase the number of non-resident students coming for diversity. They still get some extra money. It's a discounted non-resident rate, but they still get it. So they may make all of their programs of study available. Other institutions that have high levels of subscription from their own state residents may just try to leverage the program to increase into specific areas, whether it's an undersubscribed program that they want to continue to offer. Sometimes they're pretty narrowly focused. Latin might be an example of it. So it really depends on the institution and what their particular interest in participating is. It's supposed to be mutually beneficial.
And this is very different than the WAMI program that targets medical students.
Yes.
Are there other professional liaisons with other states, like for law school or other opportunities that are not offered in Alaska?
The other WICHE program, which a version of is operating through our program, is a professional student exchange program. It's a program that was established under the compact, the multi-state compact, to allow access to graduate level or professional programs. And Alaska participated in it I think at the time there were 14 different graduate or professional programs, including law, medicine, veterinary medicine, pharmacy, podiatry, through 1987. And then in 1988, because of the cost of the program, because the state is actually paying a support fee to the accepting institution on behalf of its residents. And so it was kind of curtailed and then eliminated. The program funding was eliminated. In the late 90s, it was reconstituted as a loan. Mm-hmm. And so now individual students can borrow the support fee that's paid on their behalf to the institution. Because it's financed through the Student Loan Corporation, it's only those professional fields for which there is potential employment in Alaska and the income associated with that is high enough to pay off the debt. So I think right now we've got five fields. I think they're pharmacy, podiatry, dentistry, physical therapy, and occupational therapy that we actively participate in. And what the students get in exchange for the support fee is preference for admissions. Okay. So they get special consideration for admissions. Okay. But beyond that, there are no agreements in place.
Would you mind putting that in writing in a memo to me? I would appreciate having that information at hand.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Are there additional questions?
How old is your daughter?
She's 17. Representative Gardner, did you have a question?
That was it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you very much for your presentation today. And Eddie Jeans, the Director of Finance with the Department of Education, is here, and he's a member of the Commission on Professional Teaching Practices. Eddie, I know you're not prepared with the presentation, but I just thought it might be an opportunity to have a few questions if there are questions for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. And Madam Chair, you're correct. I am a sitting commissioner on the Professional Teaching Practice Commission. I was really kind of hoping that Pat would be able to do her presentation because she does such a wonderful job. But basically, the commission is established in statute, and it's a nine-member board appointed from various areas of education. Five of the appointments are classroom teachers, one's a principal, one's a superintendent of schools. myself from the commissioner's office, and then one from a higher institution of learning. The commission members review complaints against teachers for misconduct or ethical behavior, breach of contract, that sort of thing. We meet about 3 to 4 times a year. Typically, we do those in Anchorage. Sometimes we have hearings, sometimes we don't. And the hearings are pretty formal. It's kind of interesting. You get to sit as basically as judge and jury in that particular case when we have a hearing. Our terms are 3-year terms, and members can only serve 2 consecutive terms, and then you have to move on. Pat did provide you with some handouts that show the number of cases since 1994 that she's had to review. Many of the complaints don't even make it all the way up to the commission. Pat submits them to us for approval, but she does a lot of the legwork herself and makes a recommendation to the commission on whatever the particular issue may be. She resolves many of them, and so we just have to accept their or modify their agreed agreement in those issues. In some cases, it's as simple as somebody that applied for a certificate in the state of Alaska didn't disclose something, a background check discloses that. Pat does the follow-up work for us and then makes a recommendation on whether or not to allow that person to receive their certificate or not. In many cases, it's a miscommunication type of thing. So, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about the commission and our function.
Great. Are there questions? Thank you, Representative Gardner.
When it's found that a complaint is valid and is serious, however you define that, what kind of steps can be taken, and does the commission work with the teachers union or independently? I mean, where does the union come in consequences for some of these complaints?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the complaints are against individuals, mm-hmm. and those individuals typically will have legal counsel. Okay. If we go all the way to a formal hearing, it's typically pretty severe, and we're looking at suspending a license for a year or even possibly for a lifetime. So those cases that make it all the way to a formal hearing typically are pretty severe. We could have an instance where we reprimand a person that holds a teaching certificate, and that simply goes into a nationwide database so that people know that there has been some violation of ethical conduct, but it may not rise to the level where you need to suspend their license for a year. So we run the full gamut, the whole array there.
One more. One of the categories here is fraudulent certificates, and so that would be a certificate over and above a teaching license, or maybe the data of classes taken is incorrect, that kind of thing.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I'm assuming that fraudulent certificates means you're making a claim that you held a certificate that you didn't.
Thank you.
I have a question. What if a filing has, you know, perhaps it's not necessarily justified, and a teacher is targeted perhaps because of a personality problem with a coworker or something. Does that, if it goes to a hearing, does it automatically go into their record?
Through the chair, to the chair. Pat Truman actually conducts investigations. She has the power to subpoena people to testify before her or the commission. So there is in the ethical standards, a standard that says that you're not going to make false claims against a coworker, basically. So if you went down that road and you filed a complaint against somebody and you're just being fraudulent about it, it can actually be reversed and come back on you, and you could suffer consequences for making that claim.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eddie, most of them, as I go down the line in the different categories, most of them are pretty self-explanatory, except when you get down to professional misconduct. We've already hit a lot of them up here, so what's an example of professional misconduct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. That's a good one. You got me on that one. So I would have to defer to Pat to explain that one.
Well, she'll be here, so we'll ask her.
Great. Representative Book.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you speak to tenure? Do you have that as your realm of purview as well? Do you address that? Are you responsible? Is this particular agency a part of establishing tenure? Or those are some of the issues that come up with my constituency on occasion, is that you know, their concern is that if you have a teacher that, in their view, doesn't meet expectations, that you know, they're somewhat resentful of that particular issue. So could you talk about that, Ada, please?
Through the chair, Representative Book, this group does not have oversight over tenure. Tenure is determined based on number of years that the person has been successfully employed in the public schools, and that's granted through their evaluation process, annual evaluation process. And tenure is also set in statute as to how many consecutive years you have to have to achieve tenure.
Follow up on that. The evaluation process, do you have any knowledge of that at all? I'm just looking for, you know, edification here. Eddie?
Through the chair, Representative Book, it's an annual evaluation of the teacher's performance, and the evaluations are done by the principals.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Are there additional questions? No? Okay, thank you very much, Eddie.
All right.
You did a great job.
Thank you.
Spur of the moment. I really appreciate it. On Wednesday, February 4th, in the same location, we'll have an overview on early childhood programs, including Head Start and regional boarding schools. Also, Louie will reschedule the portion of our presentation today with Ms. Truman, probably for Wednesday or Friday. Are there any other questions or information that you'd like to bring forward before we adjourn? No? Hearing none. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.